Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world. To the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world. To the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Talking with former WWRL Night Talk host Bob Law about the status of commercial and community black radio in New York. As many of you know, KISS FM recently merged with WBLS, bringing about the demise of KISS FM and only utilizing some of the KISS FM shows, not all. When radio station WRKS 98.7 FM on your dial was merged last month into WBLS 107.5 FM, people were relieved that open line KISS FM's popular Sunday morning talk show with Bob Slade survived the merger. However, other shows like Michael Basin's popular show were not picked up. There is concern that the survival of WBLS itself is under threat of being taken over, and this is one of the reasons my guest today, Bob Law, along with other community activists, Councilman Charles Barron, Michael North, and Betty Dobson of the Committee to Eliminate Media Offensive to African People, filed a petition asking that the FCC delay approval of the sale of WBLS and its sister station WLIB to YMF Partners. As Bob Law says, the important issue wasn't whether Open Line would be on WBLS, but the fact that KISS is gone. Because with the demise of KISS, the black community lost an entire radio station. And Bob says that's the issue the community really should be focusing on. Well, if some of you listeners do not know the history of black radio, I'll give you a little bit of its history, and that is in 1949, WLIB was purchased by New Broadcasting Company. New Broadcasting Company was headed by former WNYC executive Morris S. Novak and his brother Harry. The Novak brothers served ethnic audiences which targeted Jewish and African American communities. And the station eventually became the leading voice of New York's black residents and established a presence in the Hotel Teresa in Harlem. During the mid to late 1950s, its air staff included disc jockeys such as Hal Jackson, who recently passed, actor William Marshall, and Victor Bozeman. By the 1960s, WLIB was one of several commercial jazz stations in New York featuring radio jocks such as Billy Taylor, Del Shield, and Ed Williams, who together worked tirelessly to build a huge jazz audience. In the 1970s, WLIB became black-owned, when Percy Sutton, with the backing of several black investors, formed Inner City Broadcasting and purchased WLIB from the Novick brothers in 1971. This made WBLS the only black-owned FM station in New York. However, Inner City eventually fell into bankruptcy, with their stations now on the verge of being bought by YMF Partners, and that will happen once they achieve FCC approval. It is in contention of Bob Law, Mr. Barron, and Mr. North that predatory lending and the Arbitron rating system help to reduce advertising revenue, which is oftentimes disproportionate for black media, and that caused Inner City Broadcasting to fall into bankruptcy. The real concern is that YMF will simply sell WBLS and WLIB for a profit to one of the huger corporations that already control all of radio, effectively causing 2 million black New Yorkers and listeners of black radio to have no adult radio stations serving the black community or reflecting black culture. A community activist, Bob Law is the founder of the National Respect Your South Youth Organization, which established a national network of Respect Yourself Saturdays involving academia. The Respect organization has operated the Baseball Little League, a summer entrepreneurial program, which helps young people start their own summer business. Also, Bob Law organized the New York Peacekeepers campaign, which encourages nonviolence. Mr. Law is involved in film projects in conjunction with the Black Spectrum Theater in Queens, where he is chairman of the board. He is the playwright of The Magic Clown, a play for children that is still being performed in New York City public schools, and he authored Voice for the Future. Bob is also a businessman who owns a health and wellness store named Namaskar, and he also owns Bob Law's Seafood Cafe, located in Brooklyn. Well, as I said, I have as my guest Bob Law.
Oh, and he's here with us now, so I'm going to welcome Bob to the show. How are you, Bob Law?
I'm fine. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you for welcoming me to the show. I was waiting for the welcome.
Oh, here it is. I know I went on and on, but I wanted to at least explain some of what is happening. And tell me if I've been inaccurate.
No, it's good. What you said is correct. Let me just help a little bit with the history, round out that whole historical overview. The Novak brothers did indeed own what was WLIB AM and FM. And that was at a time when all black radio was white-owned. Novak brothers, Harry Novak, owned LIB, which was AM and FM, and Egmont Sonderling owned WWRL, which was only AM. And those were the two preeminent black radio stations in the city. And at that time, when they were white-owned, in all fairness to those white owners, they had a newsroom, they had a public affairs director, they had a strong commitment to serving the black community. They even set aside a block of public affairs time on both of those radio stations to allow people from the community to have access to the airwaves, put their own public affairs programming on a commercial radio station with a commercial AM and FM broadcast band. And so it was those were very effective stations serving the black community. Some of the people that you mentioned are right. Hal Jackson was there very early on. Eddie O'J was there as one of the premier morning personalities in New York City. What Del Shields and Ed Williams, and really what Ed Williams and Billy Taylor did with that jazz format was to create a jazz format that is still being imitated and used in jazz radio all over the country. There has not been a new idea in jazz radio since Billy Taylor, Ed Williams, Del Shields, the people who were on the air doing jazz at what was LIB FM. And the whole style of smooth, soft talk, describing who's on the album when they played. You know, when you listen to jazz radio, all the DJs kind of lay back and they talk like this, and they say that was Herbie Hancock, and that's how they talk. And then they say who's on the piece with them, and that's so and so on drums and so and so, and identifying all of the artists. That was the format created by those brothers at LIB, and it is still the format that is being used all over the country. But when Percy Sutton bought it, one of the reasons that, and here's our concern, and then we can kind of get into the conversation. See, when Percy Sutton bought that station, it was because there was political pressure in the street coming from the activists in the street for black ownership, that there was not a reason that black people, black entrepreneurs, could not own radio stations that were serving the black community. And that was at a time when those radio stations were what were called a cash cow. They were like, just like milking them. They were just delivering money all the time. They were the stations that were the most efficient advertising buy in the country. It would take you directly into a black consumer market that was nowhere near as vibrant as it is now. It was like $30 million a year. It is currently on the threshold of over $1 trillion a year. It's about $900 billion a year now. Back in that day, black people were spending something like $30 to $40 million annually. And so, but there was a great deal of political pressure for black leadership, for black ownership, rather. And the Novaks looked around the city. They were ready to sell. They'd been in business for a long time. A lot of political things happening on the street, Black Panther Party in Harlem, black militants, black power movement, a lot of black stuff going on. And they said, well, listen, we've been in here long enough. We don't have to deal with all of this. And they looked around for a buyer that would meet with the approval of the black community, and they as much chose Percy Sutton as he chose them. And they approached him and said, you know, we want to sell this radio station, and Percy was able to step up and put the money together and take advantage of that opportunity. But that opportunity was created for Percy Sutton by the political activism in the street. And when they sold it to Percy Sutton, they were correct that the activists in the street and the black power movement had a great deal of respect for Percy Sutton and would not challenge that sale at all, because there were sales being challenged, license transfers being challenged, particularly by a group headed by a disc jockey in Philadelphia named Sonny Hobson. And his organization was challenging those license sales, but they sold it to Percy with the approval of the black community, and for all of the time that Percy was there and involved in operating the station, it always operated in the interest of the black community.
Well, now tell me about what is happening. Why are we now
is there
no political interest anymore?
Yes. Now, what happens is that, and I'm not sure that it is a coincidence, that there's an effort to silence black voices. And I'm not sure that it is coincidental that it hits full steam right now in this election year. The black radio became, many of us believe that black radio was targeted in 1995. The Million Man March was supported almost singularly by black radio. If you remember, every prominent black and white political personality said, don't go. There was no popular support from the established political personalities for the Million Man March. Every one of them, black and white, every one of them said, don't go. It was black radio that said, go.
Go.
And as I like to say, did they go?
They went.
Did they go? Who did it turn out had the real reach and influence in the black community? And it was in 1995 that the decision seemed to be made that it is time to make black radio unprofitable, and it is time to begin to dismantle black radio and take away that significant voice. Black radio there was a time very recently when black radio was the most influential institution in the black community. The only other institution that could be compared to the reach and influence of black radio is the black church. But black radio is right there alongside, if not a little bit above, the reach and influence of the black church. And so it was black, and you know there's a, and you, perhaps people might see that there's a move to kind of soften the black church. I'm looking for the word, but it happens when they take your fangs out, you know, when they neuter you. And,
yes,
you know, they,
well, neuter is a good word.
They've got a church-based initiative that the Republicans have introduced some years ago that has shifted the liberation theology of the black church to a prosperity theology of live your dreams and make money, and Jesus wore expensive sandals and he wants you to be rich. And a great many mega preachers have picked up the prosperity theme from the Republican Party, calling it church-based initiative. So that was the move on the church to begin.
Well, in that
to,
case, they should have the money to buy their own station.
Well, they should, but it's no telling. Oh, okay, let's just come to that. In 1 minute, just keep a point there that they should have the money to buy their own station. Let's come back to that. But what happened is that black radio then is made unprofitable. The ratings company has consistently, ever since I've been in radio in the 1970s, they have consistently undercounted black listeners. You've been in New York City for many, many years, if not all of your life. Has anybody from Arbitron ever in your life asked you what radio station you listen to?
Mm-mm.
And you can Never. Ask that. And you can ask that of many of your many friends who are black. You will find that so the ratings company has systematically and undercounted black listeners. So they are giving out information to the ad industry that undercounts black listeners, so that black radio stations cannot get paid for the audiences that they actually deliver. They cannot get paid no matter how well they perform, because their performance is consistently being undercounted. Now, that's not just speculation on my part. About 3 years ago, when Andrew Cuomo was Attorney General, he brought a lawsuit against Arbitron here in New York. And the language in his indictment said that they are willfully and knowingly giving out incorrect information to their clients, both their ad agencies and the radio stations. And they are doing so to the detriment of black radio. Their numbers are so off, and black radio is being so underpaid, that it is actually causing the financial demise of black radio. Now, in February of this year, the Attorney General in California brought the same litigation.
So this is happening across the nation, not just
right.
in New York.
That's right, it's national. And Arbitron is a national measuring organization. But the Attorney General in Los Angeles brought the same litigation and was able to prove the same thing. And Arbitron, again, promises to correct what they're doing and settled out of court. I've not seen any evidence that they have corrected what they are doing, but their policy has already driven a number of black stations out of business, because those stations were not being paid based on their performance. They were being paid less money than they were actually entitled to. And then there's a thing that they do in the ad industry, which is kind of what is called the minority set-aside, where there's X amount of dollars set aside for minority radio. So no matter how well you perform, let's say there's $500,000 in the minority set-aside pot. There are two black radio stations. There's a Latino radio station. There's an Asian radio station. All of them are they get their money out of the minority set-aside pot. So no matter how well the black station performs, the powerhouse black FM does real well, when it asks for its share based on its performance, it can't get it. They say that we don't have enough money to give you more you know, all we have is the 500,000, and some of that is going to the Latino station, which did pretty well. Some of that's going to the other black station that did pretty well. Some of it's going to go to you. We'll give you a little bit more than we give the other guys, but we can't give you what you fully have earned. So the amount of money is fixed, which limits the income for black radio and what are called minority radio stations, no matter how well they perform. And so that is part of the process by which these radio stations are kept poor in spite of their performance. And if we come back just for a minute to the churches, or anybody should have enough money to buy their own radio stations. See, Bill Clinton authored and pushed through a telecommunications bill which took the limit off of how many stations you can own, and it removed all of the protections that the general public had in how the airwaves would be used. That was Bill Clinton who stripped away all of the protections.
So does that effectively say you can have a monopoly?
Yes. It says you can have, it says that you can have as many stations as you can afford. Now, who can, you can buy, you can have it, or it says you can have as many stations as you want. And the question is, and what people need to be clear about, is who can afford as many stations as they want? Disney can afford that. CBS can afford it. MS, Clear Channel, Fortress, the mega corporations, those are the only people who can afford as many stations as they want. Small black owners, small Asian, Latino, small independent standalone radio stations now can no longer even compete because they can't afford all the stations that they want. You know, Inner City and Access One, which owns WWRL, they would like to own four radio stations in New York City also, but they can't afford four radio stations, but Disney can. And Bill Clinton was fully aware of that when he authored that legislation and created that telecommunications bill. He knew that he was putting black radio out of business. That was a conscious, deliberate decision on the part of Bill Clinton to do harm to black radio.
And when his office sits right up in Harlem.
Yep, yep. And this and so the so when you say that the church should have enough money to buy a radio station, not at the prices that people are now charging, not when you have to buy four stations. You know, you have to have a cluster of stations. The if a radio station goes to an advertiser, and they go to the national advertisers like Pepsi and you know, Coca-Cola and Verizon and all those kind of people.
The more stations you have, the better, the more advertising they're willing
right.
to give you. Is that the case?
Absolutely. They will say to the advertiser that if you advertise on my station, I will put your commercial on five stations, and even five stations around the country. But if you advertise on with that independent black owner, it's only going to be on that one station. So in order to be in business, the black owners had to buy four or five other stations. They really were pressed to where they must have a cluster. Otherwise, they would be out of business overnight. And that's where the lenders come along. The predatory lenders come the same way they came into what they call subprime communities and were giving out loans for houses. The same kind of process took place with radio, where the radio owners were not, it wasn't so much that they were so easily duped. They saw all of the catches in the deal, but they felt that if I don't take this deal, I'm out of business anyway. If I take the deal,
so they were between a rock and a hard place, so
yeah,
to speak.
And if I take the deal, I'll be able to pay the loan off anyway. And so this deal is not going to be forever. It allows the lenders to have veto power in your company and vote on policy and be involved in your operation. They didn't really want to do that, but they said that, you know, we'll do that until we pay off and then we'll be free. But at least these guys are going to give us the money because the banks are turning the black owners down. The black owners found out that it was what they told us was a loan-to-own scheme, and that the lenders were making it virtually impossible to pay the money back. with their veto powers and their being able to interfere with your daily operation, they were making it impossible to pay the money back. So they were forcing people into foreclosure. They were demanding their money, and they were and they knew that you couldn't pay it. And so then they would force people into foreclosure, into bankruptcy, and take their radio stations. What happened to WBLS is not, we shouldn't really say what happened to WBLS. It, what happened to inner city broadcasting was a similar scenario, where it was not what they did on the air at WBLS that got them in any trouble. It wasn't a failure to play hip-hop or a failure to play Latino music or a failure to play any music. It wasn't BLS that was the issue. It was a number of other stations around the country that they literally were compelled to purchase in order to have a cluster so that they could remain competitive, and then found that it was going to be impossible to pay the money back. And when they and then they had a deal with Goldman.
Well, the other stations couldn't generate enough money to keep it afloat?
No, the other stations couldn't generate enough money because the other stations are being underpaid, the point that I was making at the very beginning. The other stations are being underpaid. They're not being paid based on how well they perform. They are being underpaid. Black radio, all over the country, black radio is being underpaid. If, based on its performance, those black radio stations, the inner city station in San Francisco and the inner city station in New York City, could really have generated enough money to carry the whole chain based on their performance. Had they been paid based on their performance, they would not have been in trouble. But that is what people really need to understand. And so what we are looking at is the loss of black voices. We're looking at the absolute removal of black voices from the airwaves, not just in New York City, but from around the country. And that is what our concern is.
Some people also say it's the content, that a lot of the content that black radio is forced to play certain content that advertisers dictate.
Well, yes and no. See, the black radio, in deciding to run away from its blackness, black radio decided to be urban rather than black. And like some of the stations in New York, like WWRL, they decided to be diverse rather than black. And once they decide to step away from black, they are then vulnerable to the schemes in the ad industry because, see, there's no reason in the marketplace now on Madison Avenue. There's no reason for a black radio station to exist in New York City or any city, unless it is going to take the advertiser into the black consumer market. If the black radio station is saying, don't buy us because we're black, buy us because we reach the people, which is what BLS was saying on Madison Avenue. Well, Madison Avenue says there's some 70-odd radio stations in New York City reaching the people. Why should I spend money with you to reach the people? I can reach the people with my kith and kin who I really like. I don't really like y'all. And I can spend my money with my kith and kin to reach the people. The reason that I'm spending money with you is that you take me into the black consumer market, and this is the only way I can get into that market. But if you say, don't do that because I'm black, I'm not taking you to the black consumer market, I'm taking you to the diverse consumers throughout New York City, well, who needs you for that? And so they can spend their money with a number of other stations. So black radio weakened its political posture in New York by deciding not to be black. So now one of the reasons they decided not to be black was that the advertisers were saying to them that black doesn't sell, that they're looking at the numbers from Arbitron. And they're saying you have a black format, you gear to the black community, and you don't have any numbers. So apparently, black is not marketable. Black doesn't sell. See, the advertisers were pretending that the Arbitron information was correct. The black owners would never go head-to-head with the ad industry or Arbitron and challenge them, even in court, the way the attorney general did here, the way Andrew Cuomo did, and the sister who's an attorney general out in California. See, those lawsuits should have been brought by black owners. They should have been brought by black radio. But they don't have that.
Particularly since the white advertising companies are making huge profits from the black community.
Right. They make huge profits without spending very much money, without reinvesting very much money into the black community. And they also don't ask black folk for their money. You know, they're not advertising on black anything, black radio, black newspapers, black magazines. They're not advertising anywhere. They're not even asking black folk for the money. Black people are taking the money to them. Look at the...
I was about to say that. Why are we not investing in our own businesses? Certainly we could come together and put our money in our own communities like most others are.
Yeah, well, that's part of what we have to raise with the black community to change this. See, we have filed a petition with the FCC. The FCC, more than likely, will, after we make our argument, the other side had just made their argument in response to ours, and they have said predictably, throw our petition out. None of that stuff is true. You know, we're fine, straight up, legitimate. We will respond to that. We can point to a lot of people. It's not just myself and the petitioners who are with me who are raising some questions about the credibility and the integrity of this new company, but they are board members from inner city have brought filed a petition. Shareholders and former board president has filed a separate litigation in civil court. And we have in our petition documents from other people who are all documenting that this company is a company that is not quite trustworthy. The company is saying that everybody is wrong, that all these people who are saying that we are tricky and deceitful and crooked, everybody's wrong. So FCC, throw these petitions out because all of these people are wrong. We're fine. We'll see how the FCC responds to the response that we will file in a minute to respond to what YMF has said to our initial petition. The FCC may very well, and more than likely, will rule against the people. You know, they very likely
will
rule
against the profit, right? We'll
yeah, go they go the with profit. The big guys. They go with the money. There's a sister who has just been reappointed to the FCC, daughter of a congresswoman in black media. Everybody is saying congratulations. See, that stuff, but it doesn't mean anything if we have people on the FCC who are race neutral and who don't rise up and look at the discrepancies and the contradictions. So it's like FCC will, you know, it's very likely that the FCC, no matter how strong our argument is, it's very likely that the FCC will ignore the credibility of our argument and go with the big money people. The response that these guys did, their response to our petition is flimsy. It's a few pages. It's flimsy. It raises some totally irrelevant issues in an effort to discredit a couple of people who are not even part of our petition. You know, when I looked at it, I was thinking, you know, these guys, I know they have a lot of money and they have some heavyweight lawyers if they need be. They're writing this thing, you know, like an intern wrote this. And it's because they know, more than likely, they feel that the FCC is already in their pocket. And so what's going to have to happen is that the black community, as consumers, are going to have to come together. And when you say, you know, what about us? Well, that's the step where we are now. We have to begin to talk to black consumers, and it's time to bring back black. See, black people have been intimidated and embarrassed and feel like they shouldn't say black, or there are people who have said that if you say black, you are being racist. Mm-hmm. And so there are black people who have bought into that notion that nothing of black has any merit, has any value, and as a result, all of what we have is being marginalized and absolutely taken for granted, from our dollars to our votes.
And taken away from us.
Yep. And so that is where we are. As a group, we have to kind of stand up now. We got to push back against this. We will not be silenced. We will not be sidelined, and we will not be silenced. And that is the effort, to sideline and silence black people everywhere.
The other thing is that the youth Are they even listening to commercial radio? I mean, the demographics say from 18 to 32, then most of them these days are downloading music and not really focused on talk. They're downloading into their iPhones and Androids and so. The older people are only listening, and aren't they? And isn't that they're dying off?
Well, you'd have to ask people like Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh and the Tea Party whether or not there's any value in talking to adults on the radio. They've been able to build a whole national movement that is structured on talk radio, and adults no, they're not dying off. There are many people who are listening to talk radio and making decisions based on what they hear on the radio, and they are in their 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s, and no, those people are not dying. They're not dying off. What's happening with young people is not that the adults die off, it's that young people become adults. They're not young forever. So young people they're into their 20s.
They go along with what they know or what they've been doing, or you're saying they mature and eventually say, we're not interested in the types of things we used to do.
Yeah, that is what happens most often. You know, there are young people who were interested in doo-wop music, interested in rock and roll. They became young adults. They became adults, and then they were interested in Miles Davis and Horace Silver. You know, their taste changes and develops and continues to grow, and so that process continues. But one of the reasons, though, that young people are listening to are downloading their music, those people who are still committed to music only, and part of my concern is that far too many black young people are committed to music only. And I'm talking to young people who are in their 20s and asking them about Trayvon Martin and what are your feelings about that, and they're like, I don't know. And then I'm talking to young people in their teens who are 17, 14, 17, 18 years old who are with me in my Saturday Academy, my youth and Saturday, the Respect Yourself Youth Empowerment Series, and they are very conscious and very much aware of what's going on. The kids who are in their teens now are sharper and much more conscious than the young people who are in their 20s right now. And so we have literally lost a generation. Their pants are hanging off their butt. No consciousness, political or cultural consciousness whatsoever, no sense of history, no focus on the future. We've lost a generation. We might be able them back, but we lost a generation. However, there's a generation coming right behind them that's back on track already.
I was going to ask you, because last night I had dinner with a friend who's involved in a project that teaches young kids how to become entrepreneurs so that they will know business from soup to nuts by the time they become adults. Is that similar to what you're doing?
The Saturday Academy, the Youth Empowerment Series, deals with a lot more than teaching them to be entrepreneurs, but that's part of it. But there's a great deal that they need to know in terms of culture and history and appropriate behavior, what it is to become. They understand very well what it means that they have to be competitive and self-sufficient if they are to survive in the 21st century, and part of it is entrepreneurialism, absolutely.
Is that part of your summer entrepreneurial program for youth?
It's more than the entrepreneurial program. It's part of the summer, the Saturday Academy summer program, which is what we call a youth empowerment series. So they're learning more. If you talk to young people, they were with me today at a community breakfast, a fellowship breakfast, where we're feeding people from the community. It's not a feed the homeless or feed the poor. It's a fellowship breakfast. And we do it at my church in Brooklyn, First Church of God in Christ in Brooklyn, and we feed the community. And some of the young people from the Saturday Academy were there to help serve the food. And they spoke to say what the Saturday Academy meant to them, and they say that the kind of things that they have learned. They have learned to be responsible. They have learned to be worthy of their parents' love. They say that they know they don't want their parents to love them just because they're their parents. Everybody loves their children. even the children who are causing great grief and heartache in the family, still their parents love them. These young people will tell you that they don't want their parents to love them because they are their parents only. They want to be worthy of their parents' love. So they understand that that kind of teaching and the kind of things they need to do to be worthy of the love and to be responsible people and to just it's that kind of thing and to be to sharpen their mind, so always sharpen their brain. They understand that how high they fly in life depends on how strong their wings are, and they understand that their brain represents their wings. So there's one little boy who is about 12 years old, and he says that when he grows up, he wants to be a CEO, mm-hmm. and that he is thinking that now he doesn't know exactly what business it's going to be, but he already knows that he wants to be a CEO. He doesn't want a nickname. He wants a title. And that's what we teach, you know, hip. We teach them to make a distinction between hip and smart. Hip people have nicknames. They got names like Snoop and Dupe and whatever. You know, they got smart people have titles like president, owner, CEO. So these young people want to have titles. They don't want to have nicknames. One young woman who's about to graduate from high school has charted what she's going to do over the next 4 years, the colleges that she's going to go to. She's going to SUNY at Old Westbury for 2 years, and then from there she's going to go to Howard University and take political science, and from there she's going to do some work in the community, and from there she's going to run for mayor of New York City.
Oh, right.
I'm
waiting for her.
That's what she said today at the breakfast. This is my plan. So we're not teaching them just entrepreneurialism, but entrepreneurialism is definitely a part of it. But we're teaching them that they have to be competitive and self-sufficient if they're going to survive in the 21st century. And black voices are critical. Black radio is important. These are the things that I talked about when I was on the radio.
Speaking of voices, you wrote a book called Voice for the Future. What was that about?
Voices for the Future is a collection of political essays, you know, that talked about just the kinds of things that that are going on around the world, and using the wisdom of black folk, our forefathers and ancestors, and because I noticed that they had addressed already a lot of the issues that we are addressing now, and one of the reasons that we don't pay attention to them is because we tend to think of them in a historical context, and so we see them as people in the past, but it occurred to me that their messages were not supposed to be history lessons. They were voices for the future. They shouldn't be seen as voices from the past. So when people talk about all of the powerful things that Marcus Garvey said, one of the reasons that people don't behave the way Garvey said we should behave is because they see Marcus Garvey as a voice from the past. If you understand instead that he's a voice speaking to us from the future, then what he said becomes even more significant. But
well,
what I want you to be aware of...
Go back to Africa?
I'm sorry?
Marcus Garvey's big thing was go return to Africa?
No, Marcus Garvey's big thing was that black people be self-sufficient and commit to a philosophy of self-determination. Part of what he said was we should go back to Africa because we are in America, which was particularly hostile. And he also said that we should establish a relationship with Africa. But not just an emotional relationship with Africa, but a business relationship with Africa, import, export, that we should. So he wasn't just saying go back to Africa. He was saying that we should publish our own magazines. He published one long before Essence magazine. Marcus Garvey published a magazine called Our World. I believe his was the one that was called Our World. He said that we ought to own restaurants and hotels and businesses, and was a strong advocate for black entrepreneurialism, and it was based on self-determination.
And you
but what I wanted
follow
to take,
that up.
Say it again?
You follow that up because aren't you a business owner? You own a health
mm-hmm.
and wellness store
mm-hmm.
and a restaurant.
Yep. Owned a seafood cafe for about 8 years, and then but the health store is still in Brooklyn. on Vanderbilt Avenue, and we're still there, still providing what I think is a critical service and a valuable service for that community. And see, that's the thing. When black folk raise an idea, because it was raised up by black people, it is very, very often called a black idea. And when we raise issues, they're very often called black issues. So we can't raise black issues. We can't take black issues to this black president because he's not the black president. He's the president of all the people. So black people have to be quiet because the things that we bring are black issues, when in fact the things that we raise are universal. The things that we raise are just even some black people who pointed out that the public education should be excellent, and it should be excellent for all students. Now, it's black activists who raised that, black education activists who raised that. But that's a universal issue that everybody in the city would benefit from. The white people who, if the public schools in New York City were operating the way we want them to, the black activists want them to, then white people could send their children to the public schools and wouldn't have to spend so much money sending their children to private schools. Everybody would benefit. And if black kids were being graduated with a real state-of-the-art diploma, you know, because the black kids graduating from high schools in New York City, they're getting a diploma that's worth a C everywhere else in the world. But if that was a quality education they were getting, they would be able to come out into the community, out into the marketplace, and they would be intelligent, and they would be equipped to move into the workforce and to provide services and do their jobs and do it well and earn money, and they spend their money back in the community. Everybody would benefit if black kids were getting a quality education, not just black kids. And it's like my store. It is now in a neighborhood that is being gentrified. There are a lot of white people in the neighborhood. The white people who come into our store, they benefit from the health products that we have just like everybody else. Exactly. The fact that it is a black store keeps a lot of the white people in Prospect Heights out of the store because they are white. You know, because they are white, they don't think that they should support a black business. So they make
that's their issue. I mean, black people, obviously, we go and we work in their businesses to support their businesses, but yet there's always that fear from the white race that you can't support black people. I mean, when do we ever get away from that whole thing?
Well, you see, Bart, it's not really a fear as much as it is a calculated political decision. They heard Frederick Douglass. White folk heard Frederick Douglass when he said, "Who you give your money to is who you give your power to." So they say, we're not giving any of our power to black businesses. We're not giving any of our power to the black community. But everybody benefits. If everybody benefits, see, there's some economists who say, the authors of the book, The Gardens of Democracy, they say that we are all better off when we are all better off.
Exactly.
And that's, you know, and so that is what we are saying, even in terms of radio. Our concern is that all of the media is being concentrated into the hands of the 1%. See, when people talk about the 99% and the 1%, so they look at the 1%. And what we say about the 1% is that they have all the money. We haven't said what else they have and how it is that they have all the money. They also have all the media. They own all the hotels. They own all the industry. They own all the mega corporations. You know, the wealth and the nation's resources are being concentrated at the very top. So when you look at media in this country, it is a handful of mega corporations that own all the media. They own billboards. And I don't mean collectively, individually. You know, they own the television set. Viacom does television syndication. I think Clear Channel does radio syndication. They have the major, not only do they own 1,200 radio stations, they also syndicate 90 radio programs, including Steve Harvey. They are the major syndicators of radio. They own radio, television, concert venues. They own
that's
everything.
What I'm saying, like AIG is taking up with the concert venues, and Live Nation is taking up the music and concert. It's all these companies are just putting people, all the smaller guy, out of business.
Right, and all of that. And see, when you look at those companies, those companies are also owned by another larger company. It's a smaller group that owns everything. So that when you look at what's happened in New York City and ESPN is on 98.7, where KISS used to be, ESPN is owned by Disney. And there's a number of companies that Disney also owns. You know, that they own radio now, they own movies, their television, they own all the media, and along with companies like Clear Channel and other mega corporations that own everything. The Clear Channel is serious when they name themselves Clear Channel. They have a clear channel to the ownership of everything. And so what happens is that they're making it very difficult for independent standalone businesses to even exist. And it was clear that was always the possibility from the beginning of this country. It was always clear that monopoly capitalism would just dominate everything and cause everybody else to be poor. And so there were restrictions.
So then it becomes not a democracy but an oligarchy.
Absolutely. But there were restrictions that contained, controlled how much one person can own. And then with Nixon and Reagan, the Republicans, when they are in power, they moved to do a thing they call deregulation. Say, let's get rid of big government. Getting rid of big government meant let's eliminate the controls that government had put in place to give everybody a fair chance. Let's take those. Let's call that big government. Let's call that overregulation, and let's get rid of all of that. So now we can dominate, and on our own as a mega corporation, we can now put everybody out of business ourselves. No, let there be no regulations. And so that's what happened. And then when we say there was the Democrats and the Republicans, but I mean it was the Republicans and who were primary architects of that. But the Democrats played their role as well, particularly Bill Clinton. And so Bill Clinton joined in with that whole deregulation process, and he deregulated radio.
And isn't that amusing? They called him the Black President.
Yep. And many people still do. And part of our concern, and we're running out of time. Part of our concern is that Black people need to start to pay real attention to the issues and how our lives are actually affected. We are too easily gratified on an emotional level. Tom Joyner is on the radio saying to people, I am told, that he is saying to people, never mind the facts. We have an opportunity to reelect the first Black president. Never mind the facts. It's like saying, don't bother to read. Don't bother to understand the issues. Never mind the facts. The only thing that's important is that we reelect the first Black president because he's the first Black president. And singularly because he's the first Black president, we need to reelect him. See, that's responding purely on an emotional level. Mm-hmm. What we need to say, even if, you know, Black people are going to vote for Barack Obama. I believe that Barack Obama is better for the world than Mitt Romney. You know,
yeah.
I don't know about for Black people, but he's better for the world than Mitt Romney and the people who own and control Mitt Romney. But we're going to vote for Barack Obama. However, we have to get past this emotional gratification of a Black face in the White House.
We're going to vote for him strictly because he's Black.
Well,
most people, I don't think, did. Do you? Do you think most Black people voted for him because he was Black?
Yeah, I did. They voted for him. I voted for him because he was Black. And also, it was easy, though. It was easy because Cain and Palin were real lunatics. So it was, on one level, yes. And then on another level, no, because who was going to vote for these lunatics? But a great many white people did. And be clear. Everybody, be clear. Black people don't have to apologize for voting for Obama because he was Black. Obama, the Black guy, happened to have been the most competent, the most gifted, the most talented, the best, best of the choices. So we are proud of the fact that the Black guy was the best. However,
and white people have been voting for white presidents because they were white all this time.
And why
they're knocking Black people is ridiculous.
Well, many white people voted for Palin and McCain because they were white. There was no other reason. As dumb as they are, as pitiful and as poor, as poorly equipped and qualified as McCain and Palin were, look at all the votes they got. They got those votes. Somebody voted for Sarah Palin. Anybody who voted for Sarah Palin was not serious. They voted for Sarah Palin because she was white, period. Not because she was smart, articulate, intelligent, competent, talented. She's none of that. They voted for her.
She appealed to the bias in some people.
Because they were white. Just leave it. They voted for them because they were white. White people make decisions because they are white. White people turn you down for a job that you are qualified for, not because you are black, but because they are white. They feel that because they are white, they take certain kinds of actions. So if you actually were qualified, if all the things that people, black people say, I didn't get the raise, I didn't get the promotion, and they say, well, was it your turn? It was my turn. I was qualified. I put in the years of experience. And I didn't get it because I'm black. Well, it can't be because you're black, because you just said that you were qualified. You were black and qualified. You were black and it was your turn. So it couldn't be because of something about you that you were turned down. The person who turned you down because of who they are, not because of who you are.
Who you are. I agree there.
And so that, you know, we don't get turned down ever because we are black. We get turned down because the person turning us down was whoever they are. If it was a white person who turned you down and they really were doing it based on race, if you were really being denied based on race and everything else you were qualified, then it was not your race. It was the race of the person who turned you down because of race. They turned you down because they were white, not because you were black. And so black people don't have to be it to apologize for supporting Obama because he was black. But this time, but even if we do, I believe that we have a right to say that we're going to support you. And but we want you to know there's some things that we want to put in front of you. We want you to know there are some issues that we think that you should address that's going to help us as well as everybody else. You know, we're rejecting this notion that it's a black issue, therefore you can't address it, like the quality of public education. Everybody benefits.
Right, that's an issue that benefits, and medicine, and the medical, that benefits
absolutely
everyone.
Right, and the fact that black people raise it, if we raise the education issue, if we raise the issue of predatory lending, if you can do something to repair the damage of predatory lending, everybody benefits. You know, if you can take some action to prevent it, everybody benefits, not just black people. And so black people, my concern is that black people are not paying attention to the political process at all because we are discussing the wrong issues. What's the most recent thing? Oh, when the president took this announced the Dream Act and took this position on immigration, at the end of his press conference, they showed I was watching it, I think, on CNN, and the reporter on CNN had a person on to comment on that. And the reporter on CNN said to the guy who was to comment, said, "Well, the Republicans are opposing this." You know, and so what's the Republican opposition? What is it the Republicans are pointing to that are wrong with this deal, with this Dream Act? And so, see, if I was still on the air, we would try to get even that reporter from CNN, even some other people, some other reporters, and I would ask them, why do y'all pretend that the Republicans have an opposing position? The Republicans don't oppose what Obama said. They don't oppose it on as an issue. The Republicans oppose anything he says. They have become the party of no. So why do you treat their opposition as though it is some legitimate opposition, that they have some legitimate basis for disagreeing with the Dream Act? They have no legitimate basis. They oppose anything he says. But the white press does not approach it like that. The white press continues to pretend that the Republicans have a legitimate reaction to anything that Obama does. It's just silly. But without black voices, without black radio, with the only black people on the radio who are on 5 days a week telling jokes and making a complete fool of themselves, if that's the only thing that is on the air, then the black community is going to suffer. Now, it would be okay if the clowns are on the air in the morning, if there could be some serious talk at night. You know, you can have the comedians and the whatever else, the people who are on and the provocateurs and the people who are talking about whose husband is doing what and running and just the kind of things that the black, see, there are black talk shows on television and black shows on radio that we are told are very, very popular, you know, and but it is because the ratings, it is all deliberate, it is all orchestrated so that the ratings company comes back with information that says all black people love this frivolity, they love the stupid stuff, and that black people don't like talk news. We are told that black people don't like talk and news, and it's just not true. And so that's part of our struggle.
The minstrel shows.
Yeah. And they are told that that is what black people want. There's a guy, I think his name is Barry Weissman, who tried to bring the Scottsboro Boys to Broadway as a minstrel show and was confronted by black activists and black performers. And we made it clear that, no, we don't want a minstrel show. You can't bring a minstrel show to Broadway. And he's trying to bring it back. They're going to insist that they will define the proper treatment for black culture and black history. And these white folk decided that it would be appropriate to turn the Scottsboro story into a minstrel show musical. And, of course, they are able to hire black people to buck their eyes and dance on stage. And the black people who agreed to buck their eyes and kick up their heels and grin on Broadway, treating the Scottsboro story in a minstrel show format. These guys, the black performers, will come out and argue with us that they should be allowed to do this because there's a lack of critical thinking. There's no commitment to culture, to history. You know, one person said, well, we did just some black people trying to better ourselves. What they meant by that is we have, at least we're working. And so we have a
that's
job.
That's what it really boils down to, that
right.
At least working. That's what it is.
And so there's
a
lack of...
We're coming to the end of our time, Bob. I could talk to you forever.
If
so,
I would let you talk.
Let's end it with, what are your suggestions that we as a people should do?
I want people to begin
people
to think about... I want people to begin to think about using their dollars strategically. We are being told that our money is of no value. We're being told that, but nobody's even asking you for your money. So when you pick up a woman's magazine, I think the only woman's magazine left is Essence. I don't know, maybe the Bronner Brothers. It's not black owned anymore. The Bronner Brothers magazine, Black Elegance. I don't remember the name of it, if it's still on the newsstands. But when you pick up those black publications, there's no, only ads in there is a few ads for hair care products. What we may have to say to corporate America is that there's one of your products we will absolutely no longer buy because you don't reinvest in an appropriate manner in the black community. You're taking us for granted. You're refusing to respect us. You are denying us what we are really entitled to based on our consumer strength. So we want to begin to spend our money strategically. I want people to just think about that. You know, when they raise the tuition, for instance, and students will protest and march in front of the school or the governor's office, somebody, and talk about protest the tuition going up. What if the students were to say, listen, tuition has gone up. That means that we can't spend money the way we had been spending money. We have to use our money more. We got to save some money now because we have to pay more money for tuition. So by saving our money, maybe we have to stop buying pizza. Maybe we just have to stop buying pizza and take our pizza money and start putting it into our tuition. What if the students were to say that? We're going to stop buying pizza. You know how much pizza students buy, college students buy? What if they were to say they're going to stop buying pizza? How long do you think it would take the president of Domino Pizza to get on the phone with the governor? They don't even have to target him or blame him. They just say, we just can't afford to do it. We just have to change our spending habits. We need to redirect our money now.
And it doesn't even have to be a boycott, per se.
Right. It's not even a boycott. I mean, that means that a student can go out from time to time and buy some pizza. But what if they were to say, we're going to dramatically cut back on the amount of pizza we buy? What if black people were to say, you know, I'm really sick of this. We black radio can't make enough money to even keep valuable programs on the air. And let me look at my cabinet here. What? How much Cheerios do I eat? Do I buy a lot of Cheerios? Do I drink Maxwell House coffee? I wonder how come I never hear an ad for Maxwell House coffee on my on the black radio station. Maybe I need to stop buying that. Since they clearly don't want my money, they never ask me to buy their product. So maybe I should just stop buying it. So I want people to start to just consider that. Talk to your friends. Ask them, would they be willing, if it comes to that, to engage in a strategic buying campaign, an economic sanctions campaign, where we would begin to use our dollars strategically in order to influence policy that is that can, in a more positive way, affect our community. We're going to court. You know, we go to court. The person was there's no question that the victim was black, teen, unarmed, and was killed. And in the courtroom, the white kids, the white gang that's accused, their parents in the courtroom crying, they're saying how it's all politically motivated, my son didn't do it. No white preacher, no white rabbi, no white businessman calls on the white community to produce the real killer. They never take a position against the murder of a black person. Never take a position. Timothy Dolan never opened his mouth to denounce the murder and killing of unarmed black folk by white mobs or white policemen. Never said a word. When we go to court, then if they are convicted at all, the one thing that is undeniable is that the black person was killed. But what happens when they go to court is that the killer, if convicted at all, is convicted of manslaughter, never murder. Sentenced to 5 years in jail. We understand they wind up doing about two. Like with this petition to deny that we have filed with the FCC. The FCC ruling in the interest of the public, very unlikely. The FCC ruling in the interest of the people, trying to guarantee that there's some justice. The black woman on the FCC taking a real strong stand on behalf of the people, very, very unlikely. And so it's going to have to be the people who will find some political leverage, and I'm suggesting that it may very well be in our economic power as a starting point. So I want people to just consider, if we can't count on the automatic victory of the democratic process, then we have to find another way to exercise some leverage, and I'm suggesting that it is how we spend our money.
I agree with you there, because that's nothing hard to do. That's not something that people have to go out and march in the streets or...
Right,
or
easy to do. We can move away from politics as spectacle. See, the marching in the street, when it's not connected to a movement, it's just spectacle. If we march in the street tomorrow for Father's Day silent march or to protest stop and frisk, it's one of the reasons all the politicians embrace it. It's not connected to anything. It's spectacle. A lot of press, a lot of coverage, a lot of look like I'm the leader marching down the street. It's not connected to anything. It's not a movement that is calling for any action, anything other than to protest stop and frisk. Well, of course, we protest, stop, and frisk, but we need a way that the protest can be turned into concrete political action, and so that's what we're talking about. What if the silent march was we had already identified a product that we were saying that economic sanctions are going to be used in, or any other thing that we're dealing with, if it was saying that this silent march is until... We want people to stay out of school until the mayor appoints a qualified chancellor, an educator who is a chancellor. And so with the silent march is to protest the presence of an unqualified non-educator as chancellor of the New York City Public Schools. Then it's connected to something else. Then it's a candlelight vigil in the street saying the same thing. Then it's calling on kids to come out of school. And calling on parents to keep their children out of school one day, then maybe another day, and they can't say that the children are being harmed, that they stay out of school, because the children are in the line of fire and are being damaged both intellectually as well as physically when they go into the schools. If you leave the schools the way they are, then the school system is one of the most destructive systems in this city. You do your children a favor if you keep them out of school. And of course, there are some schools that are doing a good job. But overall, the children are
You're
being harmed.
You're talking about the system.
Right. Absolutely.
Not so the individual school.
Overall, the children are being harmed by going to school and being in the school. And so what if the silent march was about that, and then there was another march, and then there was a candlelight vigil, and then there was a boycott of the schools on a Monday, a boycott of the schools on 2 weeks later, all of it connected to calling on the chancellor, who is not qualified, who is not an educator, who doesn't have power and authority, who's not doing anything, who won't even meet with black educators. Dennis Walcott refuses to even meet with black educators. And I hand-delivered the letter to him, an invitation from black educators in New York to meet with him when he was first appointed. He absolutely refused, the same way he refuses to come on the on black radio.
Well,
he won't do
Michelle.
Bloomberg appointed the woman from the publishing industry as chancellor.
Not
Kathy
Black.
Right, Kathy Black. And then he appointed Dennis Walcott, who is still there. We were to organize silent march, candlelight vigil, organize pointed to a specific goal, not just protest. Enough politics as spectacle, with politicians marching in the street, cameras in front, politicians on the front line, making a statement that I am the leader. Enough of that stuff is my position. It's time to move from politics as spectacle to politics as organized combat.
I agree. And on that note,
we'll say goodbye.
We're going to say goodbye. And thank you so much for coming on and sharing your points, which are well taken.
All right. Now, thank you very much for inviting me.
It's been my pleasure, and I want to thank my listening audience for making my topic topically yours. And this is the Blake Radio Network Rainbow Soul. And I thank you again. And please listen to what Bob has said, and let's get out there in numbers and do something about it. Lovely fathers out there, we appreciate you, so let's keep our families together.